Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's very nice to be here in Queensland again. The last time I spoke in Queensland was, I think, in Toowoomba last year, and on that note, I'd like to record. I've just been told that the world record for baking a lamington has just been set in Toowoomba. Two point four tons. With some very large number of calories, and I want to thank the Chamber of Commerce in Toowoomba for this very fine gift, recording the event, which they've sent to me, and maybe they'll see that on TV tonight. Thanks very much, Jeff, up there. I'll declare it on the gift register, of course, when I get back to Sydney later today. But thank you for the invitation to be here in Brisbane to talk about economic conditions. Of course, it's only 5 months, barely, since the city of Brisbane or parts thereof were inundated with floods. And that we saw the tragic impacts around Toowoomba and in the Lockyer Valley. It's only 4 months since Cyclone Yasi wreaked destruction in northern coastal communities in Queensland and flattened key crops. The people of Brisbane and Queensland, you all have shown resilience and adaptability in the face of that disaster or set of disasters. The economic effects of these things, the Queensland floods, and also the cyclones in Western Australia that disrupted iron ore shipments have been seen at the national level. Falls in coal and iron ore production more than fully account for the decline in measured economic output in the March quarter, which occurred not because demand in the economy slumped, but because the economy's capacity to supply goods and services was temporarily curtailed. There's also been, of course, a sharp rise in prices, or some prices, which tends to happen when supply is disrupted. And bananas, of course, are the favourite classic case of this, where 75% or so of the crop was destroyed, and with few alternative sources of supply available, prices to the consumer have quadrupled. The price at the little fruit stall outside the RBA in Martin Place was $3.50 per banana, I think, last week when I last bought one. The effects of these disasters, though, now are gradually abating. The information on coal mining is that production is gradually recovering, though more slowly than initially assumed, because of the difficulties of getting the water out of the pits. Iron ore production has fully recovered. The banana plants are regenerating and other crops are getting back to normal. And as that occurs, we should see the impact of these things on prices start to reverse. For Queensland, of course, the scars from these events remain, and they always will. The loss of the capital stock that occurred, that is a genuine loss in wealth. Even there, you can ultimately rebuild that. Lives lost, of course, cannot be rebuilt. But despite all these things, Queenslanders are getting on with things. The broader context in which these events have occurred, of course, is well known by now. The proverbial pet shop galah can recite the facts on Australia's growth in exports to China and India and on our terms of trade. It was already clear, in fact, 5 years ago that something quite profound was happening in China and in India, and my predecessor was on record at that time as saying so, and that continued subsequently and even accelerated in many cases. Then, of course, we had the crisis. The Chinese economy slowed quite rapidly, following which the authorities there responded very strongly and China's economy returned to very strong growth quite quickly. And so the trends that were in place up to 2008 had resumed again by about the middle of 2009. The rapid growth in China, in India, and in a number of other emerging countries has been stimulating demand in the global economy over recent years, notwithstanding the obvious weakness in demand from the North Atlantic group of countries where the crisis was most acute. This set of outcomes gives a boost to a country like Australia. Our country's increased exposure to Asia, which is the part of the world where most of the growth is occurring, plus the high terms of trade, make for an expansionary economic event. At present, and these figures keep changing, they keep getting bigger, actually, but at present, Australia's terms of trade are 85% above the 20th century average. Compared to the downward trend level, had that continued, that we saw through the 20th century, they're more than 100% higher. The amount of additional income accruing to production in Australia from that is 15% or more of annual GDP. Even allowing for a substantial fraction of that being accruing to foreign investors in the mining sector, this is still a very large boost to national income. These expansionary forces are at work on an Australian economy that was widely regarded as very fully employed by early 2008, and that experienced only a fairly mild and short-lived downturn at the national level thereafter. Now, as of today, measures of capacity utilisation are not as high as they were in early 08 or at the end of 07. Unemployment is not as low as it was then. Nonetheless, the degree of slack in the economy that we do see doesn't seem large in comparison with the apparent size of the expansion in resource sector income and investment that is underway. With that general outlook, it follows that macroeconomic policies must be configured in the expectation that there will need to be some degree of restraint over the period ahead. Monetary policy, as you know, has already been exerting some restraint for a while. Looking ahead, our most recent analysis, as published a month ago, concluded that the underlying inflation rate is more likely to rise than to fall over a 2 or 3 year horizon from here. That central expectation, and that's subject to all the usual uncertainties in forecasting, which are very large, nonetheless, that's the central forecast. And that suggests that, as we said at that time, and I quote, further tightening of monetary policy is likely to be required at some point for inflation to remain consistent with the 2 to 3% medium-term target, unquote. That's what we said then. Of course, it remains a matter for judgment on the part of the board as to whether that point has been reached. And at the most recent couple of meetings, the board's view was that it had not been. New information will, as always, be important in the forthcoming monthly assessments of what monetary policy needs to do. As far as prices are concerned, of course, the next time we get a comprehensive round of data will be in late July, ahead of the August meeting of the board. It's worth recording that fiscal policy is also set to play a significant role here. The fiscal impact, quote-unquote, defined as the shift in the federal budget position from 1 year to the next, is forecast to be minus 2% of GDP in the 2011-12 fiscal year, and a further, though smaller, effect in a negative direction is forecast by the Treasury in the following year. So macroeconomic policies are exerting some restraint, and that is what you'd expect in a situation like we are facing over this period. That said, there do remain, of course, differences in economic performance around the country. Given the movements in commodity prices over the past year and the stated intentions of major resource companies and all that will flow from those intentions, those differences are more likely to increase than decrease over the coming period. More generally, while everybody understands that there is a, quote, mining boom, unquote, many people would say that they themselves don't directly feel the impact of that. We've seen widespread re-emergence of the talk of two-speed or multi-speed economies. Within the state of Queensland itself, there were distinct differences in performance even before the floods, let alone after. So, how do we make sense of this phenomenon? How do we think about it? It's a complex story, and I certainly don't wish to make light of the legitimate concerns that people do have about differences in economic conditions by region or by industry. There are, though, I think, a few observations that are worth making here. The first of them is that the impact of the resource sector expansion does get spread around, even if it's not always immediately obvious how that occurs. Obviously, mining itself employs only a very small share of the labour force, less than 2% in fact. But to produce a dollar of revenue, companies in that sector spend about 40 cents acquiring non-labour inputs from the rest of the economy, primarily from the domestic sector. Apart from those inputs, there are effects on utilities, transport, business services, engineering, accounting, legal, exploration, and so on. And all those sectors, or many of them, have of course been growing quite smartly over recent times. Once these costs of production for mining are taken into account, and once we take account of taxes, which of course also flow, the remaining revenue belongs to the shareholders, and it's either distributed in dividends or it's retained in the company. It's true that a significant proportion of those earnings accrue offshore. Nonetheless, a significant proportion remains here. And in fact, most of us are shareholders in the resource sector through our superannuation schemes. We don't get that income to spend today, of course. It's in the super fund, so it's there for the long run. But nonetheless, that is genuine income and a genuine increase in our wealth. A good proportion of earnings are retained by the companies to fund future physical capital expansion. And that imparts demand to construction and manufacturing. Now, we do quite a lot of liaison with the resource companies around the country. And based on that, our assessment is that around half, give or take, of the demands generated by those investment projects is going to be filled locally. That varies a lot by project, depends on the exact project, but around half on average. So there are effects that spill over. They are having an impact, even though it's not always necessarily easy to spot them. In the end, at least thus far, the combination of the resource sector build-up we've seen so far and all the other things which are at work in the economy have to date produced a national rate of unemployment of around 5%, which is pretty low by historical standards. And in Queensland, it's a little higher than that, but not much higher. There are, of course, regional differences in unemployment, but at this point, the extent of those differences actually looks comparable to what we've seen most of the time for the past decade or so. And that period has seen both lower average unemployment and lower variation in unemployment rates than in the decade prior to that. So that's the first observation. The second observation that I think is worth making is that some of the undoubted differences in conditions that we do see look like the inverse of differences we saw a few years ago. Let me take something that I know is topical here, and that's housing prices and population growth. And these two things are, of course, quite closely linked. It surely is no coincidence that the two state capitals, that have had the clearest evidence of declining house prices in the past couple of years, and that's Brisbane and Perth, are also the two that previously had the highest rate of population growth and have subsequently seen the biggest decline in population growth over the past couple of years. Moreover, I think it's hard to avoid the conclusion that changes in relative housing costs between states, while not the only factor at work, certainly have played a role. Those relative costs are themselves affected by interstate population flows, but then they in turn feed back to those flows subsequently. And that's particularly so, as far as I can see, for Queensland. Historically, Queensland has had faster population growth than the southern states, and there's a few things going on there. It's had a slightly higher natural rate of increase in population. Net international migration has been on a par with the rest of the country, but there was historically a very substantial net flow of interstate migrants to Queensland. The most recent peak in that flow was in 2003, not long after Sydney housing prices had reached a new high relative to the rest of the country, and I think that is relevant. At that stage, interstate migration was contributing a full percentage point a year to Queensland's population growth. By 2008, that flow had slowed a little but remained solid, but meanwhile, international migration had picked up. And so Queensland's population growth overall, in fact, increased, and it peaked at not far short of 3%. In Western Australia, this same phenomenon was also at work, and their population growth peaked at around 3.5%, about the same time. Meanwhile, while all that was occurring, at least up until 2007, people were confident, finance was readily available. And so Brisbane housing prices, which had been in 2002 just over half the level, the average level of Sydney and Melbourne, had risen to be almost the same as that average by 2008, which is historically quite a high level. Following that, the rate of interstate migration to Queensland slowed further and has recently been at its lowest in a decade. The effects of that were compounded by a decline in international migration, something which, of course, has been seen across the country. At the same time, finance became more difficult. Lenders and borrowers alike became more risk-averse. That happened everywhere else as well, though its effects in Queensland seem to have been a bit more pronounced. And so over that period, housing prices in this city have tended to be declining relative to the Sydney-Melbourne average, or in fact much of the rest of the country. So the point there is that some of the differences we see now are the inverse of earlier differences, and there's a complex interaction of forces at work here. The commodity price cycle, the financial cycle, population flows, changes in relative housing costs, which then feed back onto population flows and so on. That's all been occurring. And the ebb and flow of those forces have made for differences in performance, first in one direction and then the other. My third observation is that the industry makeup of our economy is always changing. That's often a slow process, so often it's imperceptible. But over time, these shifts are very significant. There's little doubt, for example, that the manufacturing sector, if it isn't linked into the resource sector, is having a very difficult time right now with the high currency and so on. Many people might be surprised to learn, though, that the peak in the share of manufacturing in Australia's GDP was as long ago as the late 1950s. The fastest rate of decline, at least so far, was probably in the second half of the 1970s. On the other hand, things that would be labelled as services have grown quite steadily, and they account for more than twice the share of manufacturing in GDP these days. And as I said earlier, a number of those sectors are being boosted at the moment by the impact of the resource expansion. As for mining itself, Its share of GDP has tended to rise since the late 60s, having been quite low prior to that. But in 2010, mining's share of GDP was only about the same as it was in 1910. It will surely increase further over the years ahead, though no doubt, well, I think it's very likely it will remain much smaller than it was, say, in the gold rush. Again, none of these observations are to deny that there are differences and that people are concerned about those, but it is, I think, worth keeping some perspective on the things that we see. The point about long-run shifts in the economy, I think, also is a reminder to us to look beyond the immediate conjuncture and to think about the magnitude of the event through which we're living globally. For a good part of the rise in our terms of trade is really a manifestation of a large and, I think, probably fairly persistent change in global relative prices. Now, let me be clear here. There is a cyclical dimension to the China story. It's very important that we keep that in mind. But there is also a structural dimension. And the associated change in relative prices constitutes a force for significant structural change in the economy. I think we've all begun to grasp the implications of that only relatively recently. For a long time, the world price of foodstuffs or raw materials tended to decline relative to the prices of manufactures or services or assets. But for some years now, the prices of things that you can grow or dig up or otherwise extract have been rising relative to those other prices. And that's mainly due to trends in global demand. It's true that at any point in time we can point to particular supply side issues as contributing to price rises. There'd be a drought or a flood or a mine closure or a well closure or some geopolitical event working to push up prices. That's true. But stepping back and looking in the broad, the main supply problem is really that there has simply been more demand for a whole range of things than the suppliers were able or willing to meet at the old prices. And we don't have to look very far for the cause. Hundreds of millions of people in the emerging world have seen growth in their incomes and associated changes in their living standards and way of life, and they want to live much more like we've been living for decades. That means they're moving towards a more energy or steel or protein-intensive way of life, and that fact is fundamentally changing the shape of the world economy. Even if China's growth rate moderates this year, which it seems to be doing, those structural forces are quite powerful and will almost certainly continue. It's worth noting, just parenthetically, when talking about the emergence of these large developing countries, that commentators around the world have for years been calling on policymakers in the emerging world to adopt growth strategies that rely more on domestic demand and less on exports to the major countries. It's right that that should happen, and it is happening. It carries the implication, though, firstly, that more of the marginal global spending dollar is going to products that are steel or energy or protein intensive for those emerging world consumers, and less on other things like, say, luxury property in Western countries. The second implication is that more of the marginal production of the world economy has to be in those raw material intensive products and in the raw materials themselves, and less in the production of the other things. Ultimately, there will be enough steel or energy or food to go round. Supply is responding, but a considerable adjustment is involved in doing that, and of course Australia is quite prominent in that supply-side adjustment. So the average consumer in an advanced country is effectively experiencing a decline in their purchasing power over food or energy or raw material-intensive things. Australian consumers face this to some extent as well. Were we not a producer of raw materials, we would be experiencing a lot more of that. In a world like that, where we were not a raw material producer, we wouldn't have a resource sector build-up. Our currency would be worth much less. We'd be paying a lot more for petrol at the pump, for a cup of coffee at the stand outside, and for a range of other consumer products. We wouldn't be holidaying overseas the way we currently are. We probably would have some more of the kinds of economic activity that we have a bit less of at the moment, so we might be perhaps something less of a two-speed economy. But it's unlikely, I think, that the economy overall would be stronger, as it is the rate of unemployment overall has seldom been lower than it is now in the past few decades. And in that alternative world, of course, the real income of Australia in aggregate would be much lower. But Australia is a raw materials producer. So we have the advantage of being able to take part in the additional supply of the things which happen to be in very strong demand. That helps our income. I might add that while mining companies are seeking to capitalise on that, and the effects of that do flow through the economy, as I said earlier, other producers are also enjoying a boost. The rises in the prices of many rural commodities over recent years have been sufficient to deliver higher prices in Australian dollar terms for many farmers, despite the appreciation of the currency. As consumers, as Australian consumers, the rise in our currency means that we take some of the higher income in the form of greater command over tradable goods and services. The foreign exchange market being what it is, namely an asset market that looks forward, it has looked forward way into the resource boom and has pushed up the exchange rate quite a long way quite early on. In fact, it's pushed it up a fair way even before all of the flow income from the resource sector has arrived. And that's having significant effects. While consumers do seem to be continuing their cautious mindset overall, and we've talked a lot about that in recent times, many of us seem confident enough over the past year to have left the country to travel abroad at prices which are more attractive than seen for a long time. And Australia's tourism sector is feeling the effect of that, and nowhere more than here in Queensland, where the floods, of course, had an additional confidence impact on demand as well. Now, that effect presumably passes in time because Queensland's set of natural endowments that attract tourists remain. But the need to adapt to the high exchange rate may well continue for a fair bit longer. For as well as conveying a rise in purchasing power to consumers, the high exchange rate is also exerting a powerful force for structural change in the economy. One other place that I think we're seeing that is in the retail sector. The rapid growth of internet commerce, from a very small base, but rising quickly, has of course been, as you know, the topic of considerable discussion. Now, I think that was always likely to happen anyway, given developments in technology. But with the higher exchange rate, the component of the retail product that's added in Australia, think of all the local distribution and retailing overheads that are part of the retail experience that you enjoy when you go to the mall, those costs have become much more visible, and they're much higher relative to the production cost of the good itself. So the incentive for the consumer to avoid those overhead costs has increased quite noticeably. The retail sector is therefore under pressure to reduce those costs. Well, these are just some of the forces for structural adjustment in the economy that are at work, and there will be others. Of course, it's easy to talk about structural change in the abstract. We need to be conscious that it's another thing entirely to cope with it in practice. And there are no magic pill solutions to the need to adjust, and there aren't really any alternatives, I don't think, to adjustment. What solutions there might be, though, are very likely to involve a refocusing on productivity performance after a period in which our productivity growth at a national level has been, to say the least, quite disappointing. So that's a challenge we face. Yet, as I've said before, this is a much better problem or set of problems to have than those we see in most advanced countries. The event to which we have to adjust, a very big change in the relative prices of things that we happen to have a lot of, that is inherently income producing for our country. Moreover, we start this process without the legacies in banking or government balance sheets that are such an impairment to performance in so many other places. So for all the challenges we have, I think one would rather have ours than theirs. Well, let me conclude. You here in Queensland have shown your resilience and adaptability this year in the face of extraordinary events, and people from around the country have nothing but admiration for you as a result of that. Resilience and adaptability are among the characteristics we will all need to cope with a global environment that is growing more complex rather than less, and that presents both economic challenges and tremendous opportunities, in fact greater than we've seen for many years. And since I'm speaking among economists, the task for the economics profession, for all of us here, and for like gatherings and like bodies around the country, is to do our part in trying to understand the challenges and the opportunities, to explain them to our communities, and to articulate the responses that are most likely to see our country prosper. Thank you for your attention.
Ladies and gentlemen, time for some questions for Glenn Stevens. Thank you very much.
Matthew Reddy, International River Foundation. Glenn, thanks for the speech this afternoon. The Queensland state budget was yesterday, and that provides the context for the question I'm about to ask, which is how does the RBA factor into account state economic factors and its policies in trying to reduce the effects of these or the deleterious effects of the two-speed economy? Or multi-speed economy, as you put it, and to what extent is the New South Wales state of origin performance correlated to their economic performance?
That's an interesting question or set of questions. I don't have any particular comments on the state budget here, but what we try to do is to form an assessment of both the federal and the state fiscal impact, and we try to work that into the forecast for the overall economy that we see, and then the resulting demand supply balance is guiding us as to what, if anything, we should do. We're quite conscious of the differences around the country. We do a lot of liaison work around the country. Our office here, ably headed by Karen Hooper, who's here somewhere, and many of you would know Karen, does a lot of work getting around not just Brisbane but out to the regional centres to get an assessment of what's happening on the ground, and we find that very helpful. Thanks to those of you who take the time to talk to our staff when they come to see you, that's very valuable. In the end, of course, as I've said before, Australia is a currency union. We have one currency, one monetary policy, and in the end we have to set that policy for the average experience of the country, knowing that quite possibly nobody's actually at average. Some are stronger, some are weaker, maybe very few people are having the average experience. But we can't set it for the leading edge or for the trailing edge. That would be the wrong thing to do. So all we can do is try to be cognizant of those differences to work out whether they're going to feed through international performance in some important way, because if they do, that's very relevant. But in the end, of course, we have to set our policy instrument, we only have the one, for overall performance in order to maintain the value of money over the medium term, and that's our job.
Another question from the floor, please. Up the back near the pole, if we have a microphone to the other side of the room. We've got a microphone there. Thank you very much. Name and organisation, please.
Oh, hello. Hi, Mr. Stevens. It's Roseanne Barrett from The Australian. You did mention some signs of weakness in the economy, particularly house prices and falling jobs growth. Do you expect these factors to continue, and if so, for how long?
I'm not sure I said anything about jobs growth in the talk. I think the main thing I said was that the unemployment rate is, so far, over recent months, about 5%. I don't have any particular comments to make on the high-frequency flow of data. I don't think it's helpful for me to offer views on that. All those things get assessed in great detail every month. At this point, we've put out a set of forecasts a month ago, and we update those every 3 months. And so the next update in public will be in August.
Another question from the back there. Just yes.
Hi, Mr. Stevens. Renee Valaris from the Sunday Mail. The carbon tax will start in July next year. Given the cost of goods and services, in particular, will increase, and millions of people will receive compensation, some up to 120%. How will this impact on interest rates? And if it increases by a couple of percent each year as expected, plus CPI, will you have to keep making adjustments?
Well, what we've said about these sorts of matters in the past, it was about a different detailed scheme at the time, but I think the principles would flow across to this one. When there's an identifiable CPI impact of something like this, we would intend to abstract from that, to look through it, if you like, from the point of view of assessing the ongoing trend in inflation. Monetary policy is about trying to make sure that the ongoing trend is acceptably low. We don't respond mechanically to an effect that would be seen as a result of emissions control.
Table 12. Sir, your name and organisation.
Ewan Morton from Synergies Economic Consulting. One of the factors that has distinguished our economic performance as a country over the last 30 years has been the quality of our institutions. How is that preserved and maintained in the future?
Our institutions, like the Reserve Bank?
Treasury, Reserve Bank.
Oh, I think there are two important things. One is you have to maintain the highest possible quality people, and I'm very confident in the RBA that we are still recruiting frighteningly smart young people. I'm glad I'm not competing with them for an entry-level job today. So you have to have the right people, and you have to retain enough of them, obviously, through time. I think the other thing that's important is that the general community, and particularly the economics fraternity, all of you, and the more thoughtful people in the media and so on, recognise the importance of institutions and support the institutions, which doesn't mean agreeing with everything we say, doesn't mean we never get criticised, doesn't mean that at all. We should be open to criticism. But the main thing is to preserve the integrity of those institutions, you know, even if you're being critical occasionally. You know, we can live with that. What we don't want is for the institution itself to be undermined by the general debate. So I'd say the right people and the right sense of importance amongst informed opinion as to how important those institutions actually are. And I take it from your question you feel that yourself. I didn't answer the one on state of origin. I'm not sure what the correlation is. I'll just say that I think the New South Wales economy, after many years of underperforming, has kind of come up to average and maybe doing a little better than the average, and I hope that correlation flows across.
See. We have time for a couple more.
I have maroon with blue stripes. So
all right. Table 19, then down the back of the room. Table 19, sir. Name and organisation, please.
Yeah, Michael Cooper is my name, from RBS Morgans, and I work in the stock market. And yesterday our market rallied because, as is in the paper, The Australian, of course, China rallied 13.5% in growth with only 5.5% inflation. The main weapon that they seem to use to keep inflation under tow is reserve requirements. Mm. We don't hear too much about it here. We tend to play interest rates more for monetary policy. What's your reaction to that comment?
Well, I'm old enough to remember a time when we did use reserve requirements. If you go back to the 60s and 70s, I'm generalising a bit here, but that was a world where the price of money typically was not allowed to vary much. Many interest rates were regulated. They were frequently regulated at a level that was too low. And we used to try to tell the banks who to lend to, how much, please slow down. They would listen very politely to the governor over the tea and Valium scones, as that was said. Then they'd go back to their office and send the customer down the road to the non-bank institution that they owned, which is where all the growth happened. And so in the end, the unregulated part of the system became bigger than the banks. So I don't... with that historical perspective in mind, and this is from a time 30-plus years ago, I think, frankly, that if the real problem is that the price of money is too low, one ultimately will not be successful trying to tell the lenders don't lend. Because given enough time, the financial sector is very inventive in lending money. They will find a way if the price incentives are there for them to do it. So it's true that we don't talk much about reserve requirements in Australia anymore. We used to talk about them a lot, and we stopped using them because that system didn't work.
Down the back, gentleman in the very sharp suit, gentleman of the press, I believe.
Thanks very much. It's Matt Cranston from the Financial Review. Governor, there's a perceived divergence between where the RBA sees the economy going and where a lot of business and consumers see the economy going. You've done very well in explaining a lot of that today. But how important is it that everyone's reading from the same book, and what sort of impact does it have on the economy, that sort of divergence in knowing where things are going? As a follow-up question, there's been quite an increase in industrial relations disputes in the last year as well. Do you have any concerns about that?
On the industrial relations front, actually what the figures show, the official figures, is that the number of days lost in disputes overall remains very low by historical standards. So that's my comment there. On the differences of opinion, well, it's not surprising that depending on what sector you're in, you see things differently. If you are in retailing, it's hard. And one of the reasons it's hard is the things I went through in the talk. Another reason is that I think for 15 years or so, we had a world in which consumers geared up, leverage increased, housing values increased, debt went up, saving rate went down. As published, it actually went below zero for a while. This was a world in which the consumer, for various reasons, was helping lead the growth dynamic of the country. But I think that period is now behind us. I think we can't have another gearing up in the household balance sheet like that again. I'm not terribly pessimistic about the level of household gearing, but I think if we saw that keep happening, that certainly would be cause for concern. It's not going to happen. It isn't happening. People have, in fact, reverted to a form of behaviour where they're saving 10 or so percent of their income normally. That actually is historically normal. What we saw in the preceding 15 years was not normal. It is not normal for the household sector to leverage up and for asset values to go up that much and so on. That's unusual. It's now finished. Well, I think, you know, if you come from a retailing experience of that 15 years, no doubt this is a big adjustment, unquestionably. And then you've got the exchange rate things on top, as I said earlier. But in the end, I come back to what's the overall outcome for the economy? There are differences in experience and differences in opinion. But in the end, if we go down the track and we find ourselves with a 5-ish percent unemployment rate and a 2-point-something inflation rate, which is what we're trying to achieve, if that's the outcome, despite the differences, I think at a macroeconomic level, we would have to say, by historical standards, that's not too shabby.
A young lady in the sharp red jacket, down the back.
Thank you. Inya Bjornsson from the ABC. Today's consumer sentiment survey shows confidence has fallen to a 2-year low, and one of the major factors highlighted by the survey was some concern about the introduction of a price on carbon. Do you think the carbon tax issue is damaging the economy or confidence?
Look, it was a 2% fall, I think, 2.5 in that index. And just departing from my usual practice of not commenting on monthly data, in the history of that index, that is barely statistically significant, if at all. So I think we tend to want to attribute stories to these very high-frequency movements in things, and the same happens in financial markets on a daily basis. But it's not clear that there's much more than just random noise in a movement that small. The trend over time, the low-frequency swings in that thing do have some information, and it's come down from a long way above average to pretty close to average. That's probably the main story. I don't think it's very helpful to try to attribute fairly small movements, which statistically are barely really significant at all, to particular stories on a monthly basis.